I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Today on Smart City, we'll speak with two people with grand ideas for the future of city living. First, we'll talk with Tim Beatley of the University of Virginia. He's co-authored a book called Resilient Cities. In it, he says it will take intelligent planning and visionary leadership for cities to respond to environmental and economic crisis. And we'll talk with architect Bernard Zyskovich. Bernard has designed many buildings all over the U.S., but he's turned his eye to urban design in his new book, Getting Real About Urbanism, Contextual Design for Cities. All that, plus the latest news from Planetizen and our City Views commentator Walker Smith, coming up on Smart City right after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Half of the world's inhabitants live in cities, and in the next 20 years, that number will swell to an estimated 5 billion people. What is the destiny of these cities and the urban enthusiasts who live in them? Well, for an answer to that question, we turn to Tim Beatley of the University of Virginia. His latest book, co-authored with Peter Newman and Heather Boyer, describes the crises that cities face and how urban leaders can build for the future. Tim, is it fair to say that cities that are dense, mixed-use, walkable, and well-served by transit are the most sustainable form of development?
I think that's right. We know that when you look at energy consumption and carbon emissions, those qualities of a compact, dense city do in fact make for greater sustainability.
Those heat maps that some of us have seen can be very misleading because they show a lot of heat or emissions coming out of cities. But of course, on a per capita basis, the emissions are lower. Is that correct?
That's correct. I mean, the city is, if we're interested in promoting more sustainable living, the most sustainable place to be is a city, is a dense, compact city where we can take advantage of public transit, investments in public transit, and dense living and walkability and mixed use, all those sort of things that are relatively hard to support in more exurban or rural environments. And that's correct.
How do you see the stimulus package as we know it promoting sustainability or not?
Well, I don't know that I'm fully aware of all the pieces of it, but the things that I worry about, in fact, are we supporting a lot of so-called shovel-ready projects that tend to just reinforce the current patterns of unsustainable development, unsustainable growth, which tend to be very highway and car oriented? I worry about that, and I think that, you know, there are probably 1,001 ways in which the stimulus package could be reconceived to support a long-term, profoundly more sustainable, place-based vision of the future.
If we accept that cities are the most sustainable form of development, what can we then do to reduce their climate impact further?
Well, lots of things that you can do. Starting with that compact urban form is a terrific place to start. And I do a lot of work in European cities and comparing European and American cities. And, of course, there you have much more dense overall, taking the entire metropolitan region into account, much greater investments in public transit, generally speaking, more people riding bicycles and walking. So that's an awfully good start, to be sure. But then layering onto that, many, many things in the way of more energy efficient building. We could be and should be designing every new structure that we build in the city to take advantage of passive solar, for example. These are not particularly new ideas, but we can profoundly reduce the footprint of the buildings that we construct. We can make the urban environment much greener. We know, of course, that we can build green rooftops and green walls and incorporate edible landscaping, bringing back the many of the natural features, the natural hydrology in a city. Sounds like kind of bold things to do, but daylighting streams through urban neighborhoods can be done. So there are many green ways of layering on nature and green things in the city. Tree planting, of course, many cities are doing that. That will address the urban heat island problem, will provide shading and evapotranspiration, cooling benefits, and reduce our consumption of energy.
Are we making progress? Are we making sufficient progress toward these kinds of strategies?
Well, we're making a lot of progress, I think. It's been encouraging to me to look around the country and see there's almost a kind of friendly competition that's taking place between the mayors of larger cities Mayor Daley in Chicago, and your city, of course, declared that Chicago is going to be the greenest city in the country. Bloomberg has said that New York is going to be the, you know, the first fully sustainable, ecologically sustainable city in the 21st century. Even the mayor recently, the mayor of Houston, has made a similar declaration about that city. So I'm encouraged by the level of interest and activity around the country, around the world, in imagining more sustainable, greener cities. But is it fast enough? I'm afraid it's probably not. There are some cities, London, for example, that has set some very ambitious greenhouse gas targets. We need to be much more aggressive, I think, in tackling that problem, setting more ambitious goals and moving forward. So I mentioned green building. Many of us certainly support the efforts at certifying green buildings. The U.S. Green Building Council has a marvelous program, LEED, Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design. But when you actually look at the percentage of, say, office buildings that are green, that are LEED certified, it's still a relatively small percentage. So even though our problems and environmental challenges are pretty dire, we're not probably moving as quickly as we should be.
Why not? What stands in the way?
Well, I think it's many, many different factors. In the past, we perhaps haven't had the political leadership, and we certainly haven't had it at the national level, the federal level. I mentioned Mayor Daley and Mayor Bloomberg, and it's been relatively recently that we've seen, you know, this mayoral leadership. More so in European cities and other parts of the world. We've been doing actually quite a bit of work in Australia, Australian cities, and in fact, they have been ahead of us, ahead of American cities because of that leadership. So it's partly political leadership. It's partly the background condition of concern or lack of concern, perhaps, on the part of Americans. I think we've become a little too complacent about the issue. And that's changed, of course, in the last few years. But I worry some of the recent Pew polling data that suggests that Americans are thinking that climate change is not quite as important as other things. So I'm a little worried that the background political support for these issues may be stabilizing, if not waning a little bit.
Well, Americans are notorious for thinking short term. I mean, I can understand the prioritization of Americans' concerns. What do we do about that? How do you move climate change up on the agenda?
Well, I'm not sure precisely, but one of the things I'd love to see is that we find ways to mainstream it and be creative about that. I've got this new book called Green Urbanism Down Under, where we've looked at what Australian cities and states have done. And I mean, it's just remarkable the ways in which they are educating the public about climate change. And of course, they have huge wildfires right now and long-term drought. People are more concerned, of course, about what's going on with climate. But it's been very interesting to watch, for example, popular television in Australia. There's a show called Carbon Cops, you know, where it's all about identifying where you waste energy and emit carbon. There's a show in Western Australia where these families are pitted against each other to see which family can, in fact, reduce their carbon emissions the most. To have that level of concern about greenhouse gas emissions and climate change would be a good thing, I think.
When you looked at Australia, I know I've been to several cities, met with the people in Melbourne, with the city government that I think are doing so much there.
Yes.
To really change that city into a sustainable model. What did you see that most impressed you in Australia?
Australia is an interesting place to look at for Americans because, as I said before, I'd done a lot of work looking at green European cities and innovations there, and I'm often giving presentations and talking about great things that are being done in cities like Copenhagen, for example, or Stockholm or Amsterdam. And pretty quickly, American audiences sort of glaze over and say, well, that's Europe. You can't really do those sort of things in this country. We are so different in so many ways. I tend to object to that, but I do think there's something about Australia that is in many ways closer to the American experience. It's a relatively large country. It has that English heritage in terms of the legal system and property rights and politics, very some ways very similar to the American experience. And so if they can do it there, I think we can do it in this country as well. But you ask about Melbourne. There's so many ways in which the Australians have been reimagining their city. So Melbourne went in just a couple of decades from being still very car dependent, but from having a center city dominated by cars to being a place where people are mostly outside and walking and eating at outdoor restaurants, and a remarkable increase in the number of people living downtown and taking their streetcar network as their primary mode of transportation, and bicycling. So there are a lot of those sort of things that have impressed me. And again, I would say it's probably the sort of pervasive sense that we need to change, that they need to change, and the importance given to sustainability at really every governmental level. But every municipal government, and the city of Melbourne is a good example of this, has a staff focused on sustainability. And they've just moved into a new municipal office building, CH2, Council House 2, which is an amazing green structure that, among other things, has resulted in a 10% increase in worker productivity because of the natural daylight and fresh air and all the green features. So in many ways, they're walking the talk, walking the walk.
One of the things that strikes me about our own political leadership is when they tackle something like sustainability, it's a both-and situation. In other words, we're not going to stop doing anything we've been doing. We're going to add on. Or we'll continue to say sprawl is fine, but we're going to try to make things more compact. It seems that in Melbourne, they took a rather unmistakable approach to their determination to make that city more sustainable. And they actually said, we're going to really force certain things to happen, and we're going to stop other things from happening. I mean, maybe I'm wrong in my assessment of that. Tell me what you saw.
No, I think that's right. And they have an advantage in Australia in that they have a very strong regional planning framework. And that's certainly true in Melbourne. Melbourne has this regional plan 2030, which is all about that. It's all about saying, no, we're not going to simply allow the region to sprawl at the periphery. I mean, we have a lot of examples, as you're saying, places like Atlanta, where, yes, we've got more compact growth happening in the center, but at the same time, we're continuing to sprawl all around at the edges. And so they have taken a tough stance. So one of the advantages in Melbourne is this strong regional plan, and it is state government that has the primary responsibility for doing the regional planning. And that's a great advantage because that then becomes a template for investing in regional investments in transit and in other forms of infrastructure, and controlling growth so that under this Melbourne plan, they are in fact steering development back into the center of the city and into these designated development areas, growth centers around the region, mostly served by transit. It's partly about providing incentives, but it's sometimes we're just going to have to say no, that there are some things we're not going to allow to continue. At the same time, we're trying to encourage good things and more sustainable compact living. We've got to say that continuing business as usual at the fringe is not going to work.
Now, what you're saying, what you're describing is a political solution. It's a matter of political will to decide to develop land differently or make for more compact growth. So there's nothing high tech, there's nothing mysterious about what you're suggesting that Melbourne has done. I'm wondering, from your standpoint, when you step back and look at our opportunity to make the U.S. more sustainable, how much of it is a matter of political will? In other words, there's no technology mystery about it. It's simply political will that allows you to develop here rather than there. And how much of it is, in fact, technology that we need to apply new, or we need to apply differently, or we need to discover?
I don't know that there's much we need to discover. I think there are probably lots of ways we'll continue to improve the technologies that we have. Photovoltaics, so we hope will become more efficient over time. Microturbines that we can apply, vertical axis turbines. The technology's there. We will continue to prove it. But I don't think we need to wait. We don't need to wait for a technological silver bullet. We've got all the technologies, we've got all the tools that we need. So at the end of the day, it is ultimately about political will and political leadership. It's not just that elected official, though. It's community groups and citizens acting together to tell those elected officials that this is an important agenda. We've seen a lot of progress on the commercial sector and the business sector. I mentioned the U.S. Green Building Council. I think there's certainly a lot of leadership that could be shown there and is being shown, that companies are taking responsibility for imagining products and building types and things that could be, you know, much more sustainable. So there are all sectors of society, I think, bear some degree of responsibility. But yes, at the end of the day, this is often about adopting a program, making long-term investments, and in many cases, certain minimum regulations are required. All those things that require some degree of political will, some degree of governmental action.
What do we do about the low-density sprawl that we've already built that is probably impossible to serve with transit, impossible to make walkable? I'm curious, does this current wave of foreclosures offer a perverse opportunity to rethink how we build and where we build and what we do with our low-density development?
I think it probably does. And I think it probably first demonstrates how unsustainable many of these neighborhoods probably are. The idea of a large energy consumptive, material consumptive house in an exurban location that requires an automobile to get to and from, that's not going to be a sustainable model for the future. So at the minimum, this gives us some signals about what a sustainable future model of development will be. That said, I think there are lots of places, lots of parts of the country, parts of metropolitan areas where there are tremendous opportunities to redensify. In some cases, it may be shrinking city opportunity where we take out some houses and let the natural ecology return, or we daylight that stream, or we plant orchards. There are lots of those opportunities, but at the same time, opportunities for us to very creatively extend maybe transit of a different kind, bicycle mobility and amenities, and densify many places, you know, that would create new opportunities, new synergies, and new development nodes that might be important places to live in the future.
You mentioned the question of whether our development patterns are sustainable even in an economic sense. You've written about restorative economies. Describe what you mean by that.
I think most of us recognize that we've got to rethink the economic system that underpins our communities, and that a restorative business or a restorative economy is one that acknowledges that we can't be transporting things thousands of miles any longer. We're facing declining global oil supplies. We're worried about climate change. So we need to think about economic opportunities closer to home. Anytime we build a building, anytime we build a home, that's an opportunity to, in fact, source lumber and building materials locally. So we link that construction process with a local economy. So we think about a small woodlot owner who might be able to prepare a plan for long-term sustainably harvesting that wood. We think about a local brick manufacturer. We think about how we can keep those dollars recirculating in the local and regional economy. And so restorative has many different meanings. It could literally be restorative in the sense of an economic model that restores a wetland or a forest or groundwater, whatever it is, and that ecotourism and many, you know, there are many kinds of businesses that depend on a healthy, resilient ecosystem. So resilient economy, though, I think means some different things now that we're facing the present economic circumstances. So, for example, food production. We know in these hard economic times, we're worried about how far food is traveling. We're worried about its integrity. We're worried about its cost. That suggests new kinds of business, new kinds of business opportunities. So I had the chance a couple of months ago to visit with a very interesting farmer in Colorado who is actually farming 12 suburban lots. These are front yards, backyards, community-supported agriculture, share kind of a subscription farming operation. And he's also selling food at the local farmers market. That's kind of a new and different farming model. It is certainly economically restorative. It's taking advantage of the need to produce more of our food closer to where we live. It's putting people to work, and it's very creative.
And you don't have to cut the grass.
And you don't have to cut the grass.
Which would be a big benefit. Have you looked deeply, Tim, into this idea of a connected local economy? I mean, obviously, you know, there's some things that for a long, long time we're going to continue to import. I mean, we're not going to make refrigerators locally, right? But there are certain things, like you said, you can grow certain types of food, you can grow construction materials, make construction materials. Have you thought about which parts of the economy, in a deep way, which parts of the economy, in fact, can be shifted to a more local production, purchase chain, and what really would qualify there?
I've looked at it closely. I'm certainly not an economist, and I'm often my job is about traveling around and collecting compelling stories and compelling examples of what is possible. But I think the low-hanging fruit is, in fact, the fruit, growing things and producing, one of the interesting models, restorative economy models, is this idea of creating orchards and fruit production and food production in and around where we live. But it's building materials of various kinds, and it's all of those secondary industries that have to do with providing services and adding value to things. We know, for example, that a very high percentage of the food dollar that we spend, our food dollars, is spent on items that have been processed in some way. And you might describe some of that. Some of that obviously happens in a kind of factory sort of setting, kind of thing you just described. Many of those things can happen locally, and there are lots of examples of very creative local regional businesses that process things. We could be doing a lot more of that kind of thing locally. So I think, again, those are fairly easy pieces to identify. We've got to, first of all, profoundly rethink infrastructure. You mentioned the short-term thinking of Americans and American leaders. It's not maybe not surprising that folks get elected based on short-term results, but we've got to have a long-term vision. And so probably the first thing I would do is develop the pieces, the elements of that, the long-term infrastructure that we need to invest in. This would be probably a list in itself, but we've got to invest in those things that will get us out of cars. So that means local, regional transit, means inner-city rail, high-speed rail preferably, those kinds of investments. Infrastructure itself will have to be profoundly rethought so that it's not just about doing one thing, but doing many things at once and in a more distributed, resilient kind of way. So we've got to produce power, not with large power plants, but rather with renewable energy-based technologies distributed in our neighborhoods throughout the city and integrated into the built form. So photovoltaics on rooftops and on building facades and those sort of things. So infrastructure would be one thing. Second would probably be the sort of elements of greening of the city. There are many things that we can and should be doing immediately, and everything from tree planting, urban stream restoration, installation of green rooftops, all of those things that profoundly rethink the nature of the built environment. And I think those would be marvelous things to do. The third, I think, related to the previous two, back to the issue of food. I think every American city, every metropolitan area could be producing a lot more food, healthy food, food closer to home, where we, in fact, can reconnect to the farmers, the growers. And so food represents a real opportunity for us in addressing climate change and peak oil and all the other problems we're facing.
What a pleasure it was to talk to you. Tim, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Tim Beatley is a professor at the University of Virginia. His latest book, co-authored with Peter Newman and Heather Boyer, is called Resilient Cities. And we have a link to his book on our site, smartcityradio.com. Now for the latest in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
It's official. The $787 billion federal economic stimulus package has been signed into law. It's a major part of the Obama administration's plans to generate more than 3.5 million jobs and resuscitate the sputtering economy. And while the stimulus package has been controversial from the start, now that money is being divvied up, open hands across the country are anxious to get the cash rolling. A recent article from Business Week took a look at some of the highlights of the legislation to examine where money would be headed and for what. Transit and infrastructure funding has caused a stir in the planning community, with about $29 billion headed out for road and bridge improvements and only about $8 billion for investments in public transit. Another $8 billion will be dedicated to high-speed rail, however, which is seen as a welcome win for transit advocates. On the infrastructure side, more than $30 billion has been allocated to create a, quote, smart power grid, also improve energy efficiency, and increase investment in battery improvement research. Another $18 billion has been set aside for water quality and flood protection projects, as well as environmental restoration efforts. And $4.5 billion will be invested in greening federal office buildings to reduce energy consumption. So sustainability and smarter development ideas are included in the stimulus plan, though not as much as many people were hoping. Planners and urbanists can only wait and see if that funding actually results in any physical improvements to the built environment. Meanwhile, on the housing front, the Obama administration announced this week a plan to combat the plague of mortgage foreclosures that has spread across the country. According to a recent article from the Wall Street Journal, preliminary estimates were putting somewhere between $50 and $100 billion into a fund to prevent foreclosures by helping homeowners right on the line. Payments on troubled mortgages would also be reduced as part of the plan, and judges are expected to be allowed more wiggle room in reducing mortgage payments during bankruptcy hearings. These judicial changes, however, will require congressional approval, while other provisions are straightforward executive decisions. But regardless of how they're approved, officials are calling the provisions of this plan only one aspect of a broad and long effort to counteract the worst housing market seen in decades. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is assistant editor of Planetizen. Coming up on the second half of our show, we'll find out how one Miami-based architect has found a real urbanism. I'm Carol Coletta.
Hi, I'm Scotty Iseri, and if you're hearing my voice right now, it means you're listening to the podcast version of Smart City. And I have a message specifically for you, the podcast listener. We usually get a lot of really great comments via email from our listeners. They have questions about the show, things they heard. They have comments about things we got wrong or things we got right. Really intelligent input, and we thought, why don't we create a space online where our listeners can talk to each other? That's why we've created My City. My City is a social networking site for urban enthusiasts, people that love cities, people that have ideas about making the next great city. So, how do you join? You send me an email, Scotty, S-C-O-T-T-Y, at smartcityradio.com. Send me an email, I'll send you an invite, join the conversation online. One more time, it's Scotty at smartcityradio.com. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. My next guest, Bernard Zyskovich, is an architect based in Miami. His firm has worked on the award-winning Midtown Miami Master Plan, as well as working on innovations in New Orleans post-Hurricane Katrina. He's also an author, and his book, Getting Real About Urbanism, Contextual Design for Cities, tells us how cities mirror our true selves. Bernard, you write that real urbanism is the solution to creating dynamic urban spaces. Then what is real urbanism?
Real urbanism is a method of doing urban design and planning that, rather than relying on universal trends, actually looks for what's unique and authentic about the place and then builds the plan around the concepts related to the evolution of the place.
How do you understand what is real and what is unique about a place? Where do you go looking for that, particularly today?
Well, that's a great question. And there's a lot of work being done in our country related to what we all call greenfields, places that have no buildings, no existing settlement in place. And then there are others where there's either a town, a village, or a large metropolitan area. So when we're working in places that are already existent, the first place that we go to look is history. And it's amazing what you find. There are archives of photos that we're taking. There were maps called Sanborn maps that illustrate how cities used to exist in their early formative years. There's also printed material through newspapers and conversations with historians. So when we begin to work in a place, the first thing that I try to get accomplished is to understand the actual origin of the moment. In New Orleans, that might be when the city was first created according to the grid system of the French Quarter and the people that came and how that worked. If we're working in South Beach, Miami Beach, where I've had a lot of experience, we look at a lot of the old photos, the evolution of the city, some of the old maps. And there are actually projects that I've done as an architect and also plans that we've done as a planner that are a direct derivative of the history and what it's taught us.
Should the history inform the planning? Should it inform the urban design, or should it in fact inform also the architecture?
It should definitely inform the planning and the urban design, because what I believe we should be looking for is this character and personality that is existing in every place that we know about. And in many instances, it is in fact the reason that we like those places. A good example is the character of New York City, which probably a lot of people know, and how different it is moving along the street on Canal on one side to Chinatown, Little Italy, Soho, the different evolutions of the building styles, the kinds of people that move into the different buildings. Those are all elements that can help inform the city, and they also lend a lot of character to the neighborhoods. So I believe that it's clearly imperative that we do that in planning and urban design. In architecture, it's a little bit more difficult, because I think it's very important for architects to have the freedom to innovate and create and to reflect the time we're in. Otherwise, what we're doing is we're just replicating old styles for the sake of continuity and not for the message that it's sending to the future people who'll be looking back in time. So cities are not frozen, and they shouldn't be unless they're museums. And therefore, the architecture should reflect, but it should have something to do with the place. So I think there's a contextual issue to the architecture that remains important in the context of what I call real urbanism.
I think these are very difficult issues you're raising. And those who are not trained, citizens trying to protect their communities, if you will, or make them better as they grow and change, are really quite at a loss to judge whether something fits, right? Whether this plan fits with our place, whether that new tall building or that increased density is going to ruin our lifestyle, what we moved here to get. What can you tell citizens, those who are not trained in your business, about how they can more reasonably judge what is good and appropriate and authentic, as you call it, and what is not?
Well, I think you've hit the core of the issue, because the language of planning is an obtuse language. It's filled with acronyms and desires to frame things in the English language that very often don't even make sense as a sentence. So it's really important what you're asking. And just like any process of evolution, in my view, would begin with a diagnosis. It would then go to some understanding of how to predict the outcome of what's being proposed, with visual representation and with a lot of conversation. There's an epidemic, in a sense, of planning regulation that's happening without vision and without master planning. And in many respects, the primary reason that I wanted to write this book is to begin to have a conversation about the difference between something that is regulated for the point of the ease of the regulator versus the idea that I'm proposing, which is that we should really be looking for who we are. In a sense, it's almost a psychological issue. In order for our cities to really maintain and sustain themselves, we have to, first of all, discover who we want to be and how we want to look and how we want to function. And that's where the fear comes in among many of the residents, because just like they might be afraid of a tall building, they also, very often, in my experience, they're afraid of losing their character. They're afraid of becoming homogenized. And this approach to urban planning is what I think of as an additive, layered approach. First, we find the core of the origin and the history. Then we begin to develop the vision, and we do the planning. And each aspect of that, neighborhood by neighborhood, has a flavor and a character that then becomes eventually the building code for that neighborhood, as opposed to the prevailing planning concepts, which are mostly related to what I think of as a reductive way of thinking. What is the way to calm our streets? What is the way to create a predictable storefront? What are the ways to establish a rule for setting back the towers? And what ends up happening in that is that rather than it having anything to do with the context or the place, it's really oriented toward a reductive, homogenized approach to planning, which is very easy for people to regulate, but doesn't, in my opinion, produce great places. It's kind of like when I was a kid and I would travel with my family across the country, and all that was available was AM. And probably a lot of the listeners remember this. And you'd go from place to place. And in the South, you had country music and bluegrass. And then you'd drive up to the Northeast and it would become jazz and blues. And every place was kind of broadcasting its own personality, its own sense of place. And what we're missing today, I believe, is you go to any shopping center. What every developer wants is he wants that credit tenant. Of course, in today's economy, they'll be happy with anybody. But typically, you want somebody who's going to be existing with a very big bottom line. So the idea of a shopping center is predominantly they all look more or less the same. And when you look at the shops, they all sell the same stuff. And when you remember what it used to be like with mom and pop stores and different kinds of things happening along the street, I think that's very analogous to what's happening in the concepts of planning. We should be very skeptical and fearful of plans that homogenize us. And we should really embracing and be searching for things that create character and create personality and create a sense of excitement and unpredictability and potential. I almost see it as an issue of fear versus hope. You can create a plan that's defensive, and you can also create a plan that is full of opportunity.
And certainly many decisions that are made at City Hall are based on fear. Fear of being sued, fear of being accused of treating people unequally. How do we move from what we have today, which produces homogeneity and mediocrity, and where you think we need to go toward real urbanism?
As I've traveled and done my work in different cities, I find that people don't actually have the same conversation when we have our public meetings. In New Orleans, after the flood, it was one of desperation and anxiety. I'd never experienced that level of human interaction before as a professional. It required us to completely change. But what they were really talking about once you got past the fear is this sense of anxiety about the future, because New Orleans had built its entire city around these districts and wards that each had their own personality. And they were afraid of who was going to move in and who was going to be disrupting it. When you go to downtown Miami or some of the places that have had extreme booms, you find people who mostly are afraid of having a very big building next to their single family home. So it's a completely different conversation. But when you get down to it, it's still oriented toward the fear. In other places like Jacksonville, it's a very suburban orientation to a city. People don't want plans around transit because they're afraid that the idea is going to be to put shops inside their single family neighborhoods and that they're going to suddenly have to take buses. That is not what anybody wants to do. So I think that you begin to create a plan that is not based on homogeneous thinking by having your first visioning and your first planning dialogues and your first draft of what is coming up, always to be related back to how the city began and to the form of the city, to the nature of the city, to the context, to the types of jobs, to the evolution of neighborhoods. And it's very easy to point out to somebody and say, well, you know, your city used to look like this in 1935, and now it looks like this in 1960, and here we are 50 years later, and who do you want the city to be? But we shouldn't lose these things that we used to have. And I think that you can do it like that. You can talk to people about their potential rather than only their fear.
I wonder, though, to what extent, Bernard, do you feel the need as a planner, as an architect, to lead the thinking of people who have not experienced anything other than what they know today? Aren't there some larger issues at play? Let's just take one of the largest, climate change. I mean, we are living in a way that is destroying the climate. We are living in a way that makes us dependent on foreign oil. Do you feel a larger responsibility to help people not only get what they've got, but change what they want?
Absolutely. That's really what I'm trying to say is we're all limited by our own experience and our own imagination. So what we're going to get back is what they already have. And you begin to look into what makes a place more unique and authentic. It is really very much like a psychiatrist asking the patient to talk to them about themselves. Eventually, you end up with a response from the professional that will hopefully try to weave together the ideas that everyone's been speaking about and present a picture of what could be that far exceeds what their imagination would have allowed them to do in the first place. So I think you're absolutely right. There are things, especially here in South Florida, where I work a lot related to coastal change, and people don't understand fully the impact of what that means to a coastal community where every building is built at a certain elevation, and suddenly you have to raise that elevation by 8 feet in order to meet the flood criteria. How would you get into a store that's 8 feet above your head? One size does not fit all. That's the whole point that I'm getting to, that not only nationally and regionally, but even within a city, there's a need to begin to differentiate neighborhoods, to create a conversation among people as to where's our business center most likely going to be, what should be the nature of that, versus here's a historic community made of cottages. How do we protect the cottage feeling while still giving people new economic opportunity? So it's very important to do exactly what you're saying, to be able to speak to people in a way that gives them an indication that's greater than the one they would come up with on their own.
You mentioned your work in downtown Miami, and I know, of course, there's been a lot of construction of residential condo units in downtown Miami, which I'm sure is sitting there quite empty at the moment.
Right.
But your job specifically was to revive the jewelry district. And I'm curious, describe that district for me and also your approach to rejuvenating that area of downtown Miami.
Well, the jewelry district is an area that's in the kind of the epicenter of the original downtown. When Henry Flagler started his railroad prospects in downtown Miami, he never really thought Miami would be the largest city. It was really Key West he was after. So the city was laid out in very narrow streets, 60-foot right-of-way, 70-foot right-of-way. And the buildings that came up over a series of decades. So the Jewelry District is a very compact area. And it's on streets that are relatively narrow. And they're in buildings that are from the 40s, mostly. So smaller windows, very deep floor plates. And what the Jewelry District is a compilation of many, many, many businesses. It's comprised predominantly of businesses with just one, two, or three people in them. So they end up taking a very small office, and you'll find almost like a rabbit's warren of people that are dealing with precious metals and stones but don't really have any place to interact. The Jewelry District is actually an older project for the downtown as a way of stimulating the economic prosperity of downtown, because like so many other cities, the money left for other places with more suburban development, and downtown Miami, unfortunately, is still suffering from a lack of rejuvenation in its downtown core, notwithstanding the fact that we now have 50, 60-story buildings along the waterfront. So the concept was to change the urban environment by changing the public domain, by putting in landscaping, new sidewalks, bringing the streets up to a very desirable and safe-feeling visual, and implementing some new ideas like a unified marketing strategy. Rather than search for parking, have a valet system for the downtown so you can drop your car anywhere and pick it up anywhere. Also trying to find the funding to create a jewelry center where the jewelers themselves could have interaction among each other and begin to talk about their businesses with each other, which is a place that doesn't exist right now. Everyone tries to find a way to meet in a small coffee shop, and it doesn't really work that well. So those were some of the ideas. And even though it's a very small project, it actually embodies a lot of the thinking, which is the conversation with the jewelers trying to uncover what they really needed and an economic underpinning to make sure that it's implemented.
Tell me a little bit more about how you approached this challenge of finding a place for people in an industry, in a cluster, to connect with one another. I think that's a need that goes unmet in a lot of places. So how did you think about providing for that need?
Well, back in the beginning of the city, there were many buildings made with very large bank lobbies, by example. Because the old days, you would go into a bank, there were no ATMs, there were no electronic transfers, everything happened by hand. People would come in, as they do today from the jewelry center, with precious metals that need to be stored in a vault. So we identified several bank buildings that had lobbies on the second floor of the building, which were basically vacant. And what we were trying to do was to figure out a funding source whereby one of those spaces could be turned into like a jeweler's club as a business for someone, possibly with some public help, as a way of instituting the same type of an idea that began with the banker's club or a club of attorneys, so that there would be a common space. So a lot of the buildings, especially in the older downtowns, there are many spaces that have very high ceilings, that are quite beautifully detailed, that have nicer materials than you would find today. And they sit underutilized because the owners of the buildings can't figure out how to utilize that space.
I want to return to this question of real urbanism. Is it okay for people to drive miles to arrive, say, at a 3 or 4 block destination that feels authentic and perhaps is authentic, but it is essentially separated from everything else?
Well, the answer is there is no answer to that because the market dictates some of that. But the conversation about real urbanism is really, in many respects, an alternate to what a lot of people call new urbanism, which is about how do we create a vital city where things really work well. And I think scale, as you mentioned, has a lot to do with it. So real urbanism is an idea that was birthed in the concept of large metropolitan cities, big downtowns, so that the way toward revitalization could occur with some underlying logic, which we're tying back to history and economics and transportation and those types of things. The place that it becomes blurred between the concepts and philosophies that I'm speaking about versus the ones that we might think of as more homogenized is as it approaches a greenfield. So a place that's only 1 or 2 blocks that you have to drive miles to is a beginning in terms of a satellite. It would be better to try to revitalize the center of the city if possible. But I'm the first to acknowledge that people who live in neighborhoods that are remote from the downtown don't want to feel like they have to go downtown in order to have a real experience. So revitalizing the Main Street idea is really a good one, and it's happened throughout the country. But real urbanism makes a distinction between the different types of cities and the different types of investments that are created.
Let me ask you one more question. In your book, you cite a number of examples of real urbanism at work. Which do you think are the best examples of real urbanism?
The best examples are perhaps South Beach, which had an assembly of older buildings. It was essentially an area that had very poor people, many of them retired, very little happening that was new. And the understanding that you could actually take what would have been a huge demolition project in what's now called the Art Deco District, actually saving 800 buildings that are very, very modest and realizing there's enormous power in building on top of something that already has all that character. And when you look at Miami Beach today and you look at Frank Gehry doing a new concert hall, it really proves the fact that cities need to have the flexibility to embrace new ideas, but also need to be careful not to take away the character that made them in the first place. So that's a really good example. The purpose of real urbanism is to open up the conversation, to get people to begin to think about what is the personality, what is the character of my place, and how do I want to see it grow into the future? And not so much about how do I prevent something from happening, because to tighten down the valve is easy. To open it up and get creative expression and new thinking is not so easy and impossible after those new regulations go into place. So we have to be very careful about what we wish for.
Bernard, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you so much, Carol. It's been my pleasure.
Bernard Zyskovich is the founder of Zyskovich Architects in Miami. To read more about his real urbanism, head to our website, smartcityradio.com. Finally this week, Walker Smith joins us with a new perspective on the choices we make as consumers.
President Obama has a new favorite word, and it's a good one. The word is responsibility. In his election campaign, he first used it with prominence in a speech he gave on October 13th, 2 days before the final debate in Toledo, Ohio. This was his major policy speech on the economy, and in it he forcefully called for a new ethic of responsibility. 2 days later, during the debate itself, in response to a question from moderator Bob Schieffer, Obama said we must begin to embrace a culture and ethic of responsibility. After the election was over, Barbara Walters conducted the first post-election interview with Barack and Michelle Obama. During this interview, Obama expressed concern about the tone-deaf captains of industry who were asking for bailouts without showing restraint and sensitivity. He was thinking specifically of the CEOs of Detroit's big three auto companies. He said they needed to think more about their responsibilities to their workers, community, and shareholders. Then, in his inauguration speech, Obama again made responsibility a major theme. He blamed the financial crisis on greed and irresponsibility, and he closed by telling Americans that what is required of us now is a new era of responsibility, something that is both the price and the promise of citizenship. Responsibility is something that each of us, as individual citizens, must adopt in our lifestyles and in the choices we make. We all applaud President Obama when he speaks of responsibility, and we look forward to the things he plans to fund and put in place to enforce this ethic and to create the opportunity for us to be more responsible. But let's face it, it's not going to be easy. For one thing, we don't have a lot of practice at being responsible in the ways that President Obama has in mind. We make lots of choices without a second thought, and we get annoyed when we are forced to second-guess our preferences because they might have an impact beyond our own interests and needs. We've known for decades, for example, that big houses and big cars are inefficient and energy-intensive, but these kinds of second thoughts have not troubled us. Now that we have become comfortable in these sorts of lifestyles, I think it will be hard for us to contemplate different choices. Indeed, I think the biggest challenge we will face in answering this call to responsibility is the fact that we have invested so much of ourselves in shopping and buying. Mind you, I'm not criticizing this. It's certainly true of me. I'm just reflecting on it and worrying that responsibility will mean a different way of finding things that fully satisfy us and engage us in the kinds of things that make us happy. After all, we live in a consumer-driven society. Economists have made this point over and over again for the past several months when they talk about the impact of a drop-off in consumer spending. And the key feature of a consumer-driven society is the cycle of consumption. We have a long way to go on this road to responsibility, but clearly it is a journey we must take. We just have to think harder about how much stuff we really need to take with us along the way. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of the Yankelovich Monitor, a trend service of the Futures Company. He joins us each week from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta, and his latest book is Generation Ageless. There's a lot more Smart City on our website. Join us at smartcityradio.com to sign up for our newsletter, subscribe to our podcast, or contact us. Let us know how we're doing. Click on the contact button or send us an email at questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit hydefoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our producer and engineer. He has seen the end of his computer problems for now. I'm Carol Coletta.